Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Michael Fullilove, the Executive Director at the Institute. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to today's event with one of Britain's most eminent academics and an old friend and teacher of mine, Sir Adam Roberts. Ladies and gentlemen, we recently published a terrific article on The Interpreter by Sir Lawrence Freedman, a friend of Adam's and mine, on Brexit. And we're doubly lucky now to hear from another highly qualified British expert in person. Sir Adam Roberts is one of Britain's leading scholars of international relations. He studied modern history at Oxford. He was lecturer at LSE in international relations. He then moved to Oxford, where he was first of all the Alistair Buchan Reader in IR, and then as Montague Burton Professor of International Relations from 1986 to 2007. He was president of the British Academy from 2009 to 2013. Adam was knighted by Her Majesty at Buckingham Palace in 2002, and I asked him what benefits you get from joining that club. He said that placement at dinner parties tends to improve, but apparently there are no upgrades on airlines. Adam is now the Senior Research Fellow at the Centre for International Studies at Oxford, and his research focuses on international security, international organisations, and international law. He's published in all the top journals, and he's the author of a number of fine books. I first met Adam at Oxford about 20 years ago, and he was my supervisor, and I remember making a classic faux pas in the first meeting with Adam and the whole IR class, where I naturally, as an Australian, introduced myself as Michael and referred to him as Adam. And then I watched as each and every other classmate of mine referred to him as Professor Roberts. But Adam never took offence. He's very relaxed about these things.
Well, and about Australians.
There you go. And I think that's why he gets on well with Australians, because he's an informal person despite all the wonderful things he's done. And I was very lucky to have him as my supervisor. I've always thought Adam is the classic Oxford Don, in the sense that he reads very widely. Often American academics are very narrow in their focus, but I always felt with Adam that in any particular room, around any table, it was often Adam who would sort of crystallise the comment at the end with a witty remark or something that sent you on your way with something to think about. In Sir Isaiah Berlin's fox-hedgehog dichotomy, I think, Adam, you're a consummate fox, if you don't mind my saying it. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Adam. And today we're going to talk about Brexit. And let me briefly remind everyone, in case you've lost track of where the debate is up to. In 2013, in a legacy-wrecking act, former Prime Minister David Cameron promised a referendum on the UK's membership of the EU. So he said that in order to solve temporarily an intra-party dispute, he would put Britain's membership of the EU, and at that stage, actually, the whole edifice of the European Union, up for grabs. On the 23rd of June 2016, the UK voted to leave the EU. Mr Cameron resigned, and he was replaced as Prime Minister by Theresa May, who won re-election by a very thin margin in June 2017. There's then been the process of negotiating a withdrawal agreement, which was voted down by the UK Parliament in January. The UK now faces a looming deadline to leave the EU on 29 March, but the government's negotiating position is not clear. The Europeans are issuing grim warnings about the consequences of Brexit, and now that deadline is looking more and more rubbery. So, Adam, let me begin, I guess, by asking you to put your prejudices on the table so we know where we stand. What do you think about Brexit? What did you think at the time of the vote? Is it an historic mistake? Is it a swashbuckling opportunity for global Britain? Or is it just something that Britain will probably muddle through with and end up with something that's not so dissimilar from what they had? What do you think of Brexit?
Well, since you ask, Michael, from my personal view, I'll tell you straight in an autobiographical form. I thought that the whole debate at the time of the referendum was absolutely dreadful. I'm afraid I was You could argue that I was being superior and posh, but I thought it was full of lies, misrepresentations, and also full of very simple arguments on a purely economic level when a lot of many deeper issues were involved. And so disgusted was I by the debate itself that for the first time in my life, I took a postal vote and recorded a postal vote and disappeared with my daughter to do a cycle ride from the easternmost point of Britain to the westernmost point of Wales to take our minds off Brexit, which of course completely failed, because as soon as you get out of towns, you get into a countryside where there is much higher support for Brexit. So posters galore we saw en route. I thought that the outcome of the referendum would be 48 to 52, but I got it the wrong way around, and I was not the only one who did that. So that gives you a sense of where I'm coming from, but I don't think it gives you a full view of the complexity of the whole issue, which even I felt, because I'm not in love with the European Union. I'm not uncritical of it. I think that there are weaknesses in it. When I think about the European Union, I often think about my dear Australian colleague and predecessor in the Montagu Burton Professorship, Edley Bull, whose book The Anarchical Society was precisely about the relation between sovereign states on the one hand and a larger international society on the other. And Hedley was a firm believer in sovereignty, but equally a firm believer in international society and its institutions. And arguably, I don't know what he would have thought, I can't say. Sadly, he died many, many years ago now. But I think that he would have felt, I certainly felt, that the European Union went rather far in turning itself into something close to a super state. And I think he would have been sympathetic to Britain's nervousness about that. But of course, we had carved ourselves out a role in the European Union that left room for individual states to exercise their traditional roles. So I think Hedley would have accepted that. I think he would have voted yes in the referendum. Yeah.
So I think one of the things that's mystified a lot of Australians is we normally expect the Brits to focus on their own interests in a very particular way. We normally expect a certain level of competency and efficiency from the British state, from the deep state, from the parliament. And so it's been a bit odd for a lot of us, first of all, to the initial decision, which meant probably, we'll come back to this later, but probably a diminution of Britain's influence in the world and certainly a long period of distraction from the world as it resolves these complicated issues, but then the extreme messiness of the process. So what is it that explains that decision? Why has it been so hard to digest? Why has Britain seemed to have lost its senses? Or to ask the question another way, what is the origins of this British nervousness that you talk about European federalism?
I think there are two things that have date way back and helped to explain this problem. One is the notion of sovereignty has attracted people in Britain in a way that it has not in continental Europe, because we have not experienced foreign occupation and all the tragedies and disasters associated with that, and which in the case of almost all European countries left them with a sense that we need to be part of a larger and stronger union if we are to survive. The French had the best army in the entire world and still suffered dreadfully in two world wars and so on and so forth. So there was that sense of a larger union. There was also an attachment in Britain to sovereignty on sort of grounds laid out by John Locke in the 17th century. He actually wrote in one passage that parliaments of a state cannot give up their powers to a larger external entity. It is the very essence of being a democratic state that power has to reside in parliament. So he sees there as being an inevitable tension between being a full practicing democracy and being part of a larger union. And I'm not saying that many of the Brexiteers had read their John Locke, no sign of that, or any other political theorists necessarily, but rather that the language of politics in Britain gave itself to that notion. And the very slogan of the Brexiteers, "Make Britain Great Again," very like Trump's "Make America Great Again," it was a very similar appeal to some notion of a mystical past where everything was simple and where we stood on our own feet.
And so often the time that is conjured up is that period in the middle of 1940 when Britain stood firm and resisted the threat from the continent. What do you think Winston Churchill would have made of the European Union? Do you think he would have voted for Brexit or not?
Churchill famously made a speech in Zurich, and I think it was 1946, but very shortly after the Second World War. And there was huge interest in Churchill and admiration for him in Switzerland. Rather curious that a neutral state should be home to such admiration, but it was. And Churchill made a passionate plea for it. His speech was entitled "Europe Must Unite," and the Swiss were literally standing on the rooftops to hear him. He spoke in a square in Zurich, and there's one photograph of the event, which you can find upstairs in the restaurant right on the edge of the square, which shows all the people standing on the rooftops at risk to their lives to hear this speech. And Churchill was impassioned that Europe must unite, and particularly France and Germany must unite. But one little detail that he didn't, and wisely didn't, enter into in this speech was whether Britain would have to be part of this unity or not. So even Churchill was capable of, as it were, avoiding big issues on occasions.
One of the recent biographers of Mr. Churchill was Boris Johnson, the former Foreign Secretary. And we hosted Boris twice, once in 2013 when he was the Mayor of London, and again in 2017 when he was Foreign Secretary. And when he spoke to us in 2017, he spoke about global Britain and about Brexit really presaging a re-entry into the world. And this was an argument that was made a lot during the campaign, that Britain had been constrained by the European Union. It wasn't able to really feel its oats. It had got distant from countries that historically it had a lot to do with in the Commonwealth and so on. What do you make of this? Do you think that, are we looking at global Britain if Brexit proceeds, or is it something a little more dispiriting?
Well, Boris Johnson was a student at Balliol College, Oxford, not a student who I ever had the pleasure of teaching. But I have to say that no one has ever accused Boris of being a detail man. His record in administration is an absolutely shocking record of money wasted on absurd projects, of which the Thames Bridge, the Garden Bridge, which was a bridge purely to house a garden and to be a pedestrian bridge, there wasn't even going to be a cycle lane over it. This project lost millions. Wherever he's been, including in his time at the Foreign Office, detail he has not been strong on. And the devil is always in the detail in virtually any issue, and rhetoric only gets you so far and no further. And frankly, I have to say it, I think quite a lot of the time as Foreign Secretary, he was a buffoon and an embarrassing buffoon. He was not without some depth of understanding, but he wasted it.
What about the argument, though? I mean, Boris is not the only person to say that the process of having to achieve consensus with European partners and so on slowed down British foreign policy from time to time. What do you think would be, I mean, what are the likely positive impacts on British foreign policy of Brexit, and what are the negative impacts in terms of having, I mean, one thing that I notice is that in the old, under the current dispensation, if Britain can mobilise European opinion in a certain way, then you have a whole bloc behind you, as opposed to simply being a mid-sized country. But what would be the advantage, what would be the effects, do you think, on British foreign policy if we can get through the next sort of 10 years and come up with a with an acceptable Brexit?
We live in a world where there's an increasing number of powers, successful states, and I think part of the strength of Brexit's appeal was that sense that Britain had lost its position in the world and wanted to recover it. And that sort of focused on Brussels as the main constraint. And it's hard to see how, in very different circumstances from those in which we joined the European Union, we could, as it were, recover this imaginary greatness. To give one obvious example, I know that when we originally joined the European Union in the 70s, there was strong feeling in Commonwealth states, including Australia, that Britain was abandoning a long period of loyal involvement in the Commonwealth and trading with the Commonwealth, and was turning away to Europe. And that was painful, but there's no way in which you can recreate that old set of relationships. Australia's moved on. Other countries in the Commonwealth have moved on and developed their relationships with others. And it's not likely that, that Britain could recover major influence in that way. When I came here this morning, I came partly down Castlereagh Street, and I was reminded of a man who was one of the truly great foreign secretaries. And he was a great foreign secretary through the clarity of his thought and the considerable courtesy of his approach in dealing with other states. He was not superior to them. And his difficulty, which is relevant to Britain's difficulty today, is that English opinion wasn't really ready to commit to Europe. He wanted to build up the Concert of Europe in the years after the Congress of Vienna in 1815 to establish a peace system in Europe where the great powers would manage it. But English opinion was always lagging behind, dragging its feet. And I think that that problem is likely to remain, whether we're talking about Britain, as it were, trying to establish greatness again in a general way, as you hinted, or whether we're talking about its role within Europe. There is that enduring problem of British opinion.
What about the effect on the broader world of Brexit, and in particular the effect on the West? I mean, it's been very noticeable to me that in the period the Institute has existed, the West has sort of visibly deflated, partly, I think, as a result of the 9/11 wars and the inability of their countries to successfully prosecute the 9/11 wars, partly the global financial crisis, partly a growing sense that our governments are not capable of doing the things that they're promising us that we can do. And then at the same time, we have resurgent adversaries, if you like, in capitals like Moscow and Beijing that appear to have purpose and are pushing back and are exploiting our weaknesses in lots of different ways. Britain exiting the EU will at the very least make the EU smaller, probably less liberal, because Britain had a liberalising effect on it. You have to think that it's a wonderful result, for example, for somebody like Mr. Putin.
Yep.
It will, my own view is, it will distract Britain, which has been a pillar of the international order, and probably for the next 10 years, Britain will be quite focused on internal matters and resolving this relationship with Europe rather than going abroad to fight monsters. Am I being too negative? What kind of impact do you think Brexit will have on the West as an entity?
So far, there's a lot of evidence to support that pessimistic interpretation of what's been happening. And of course, when one adds in the element that you only alluded to in a very brief and delicate way of the troubles in the United States at the moment, it is the two great Anglo-Saxon liberal democracies, both in terrible trouble at the same time. That has a knock-on effect on the confidence of others. And many European colleagues bemoan this state of affairs and do feel that Britain's influence is diminished, and ask any member of the British diplomatic service in a private moment, as it were, and they will feel the same. They will say the same. They're not in much doubt that the attractiveness of Britain has gone down considerably. And part of the reason for that is when you have a reconsideration of the constitutional order of such a fundamental kind as Brexit turns out to involve, especially, of course, in relation to Northern Ireland, but also in relation to Scotland, when everything is up for grabs, the potential for disagreement and conflict suddenly becomes very great. I don't want to be overdramatic about it, but it's not unlike the time when in the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, it had been under Tito, but when they had their first free elections in 1991, everything started to fall apart because the old stability, the sense of permanence, had gone. In Britain, the question of Ireland, as ever, is a genuinely difficult question. And I've been asking for 3 years, ever since before the referendum, all the people I know about Ireland, is there any way of Britain being out of the European Union and out of sync with its customs arrangements, and at the same time having a borderless, frictionless frontier with the Republic of Ireland? And this is a subject, as you know, that is being explored in negotiations as we speak in Brussels. But the answer that I've always had from whoever I asked about this, and that involved many Brexiteers as well as others, was always that they couldn't see a way around that problem. And it is something that people seem to have forgotten in many areas of the Brexit discussion, not only among the Brexiteers themselves, but among their critics, is some problems in international relations and in politics are just inherently very difficult. And when, sorry to harp on it, but when Boris Johnson said, we're going to make a Titanic success of the Brexit negotiations, an unfortunate phrase, there was no recognition just of the inherent, trade talks are tough at the best of times, any trade talks. To have a complete reconstruction of your trading arrangements is extremely difficult, internally as well as externally. Working out what you want is extremely difficult. So when all that goes up for grabs, yes, there is a loss of ability to address the problems of the rest of the world. I'm not a total pessimist about the rest of the world, and I don't believe that democracy is on retreat everywhere. I spent a week in Tunisia in January, and it's very, very interesting to see how one country, and only one, has made something good of the Arab Spring. and has developing in a constitutional way, there are plenty of threats that they face, many countries that do not want them to succeed. But look again at Armenia, where an attempt to create an authoritarian regime has been rejected. And it isn't true that the pattern is uniformly one against democracy. And local factors in many countries work in the other direction, thank goodness.
I'm going to come to the audience in a couple of minutes and give you an opportunity to ask Adam a question. But before I do that, let me come to the negotiations. We've been discussing this issue as though Brexit will happen, but of course it's not a foregone conclusion, and the debate is moving all the time. And recently we had, I think it was 8 Labour MPs and 3 Tory MPs defect from their parties and establish a new independent group of MPs, largely, I think, over the issue of Brexit. I think that contributed to Mr. Corbyn coming out in favour, for example, of a second referendum. If you were a betting man, Adam, how do you think things will play out in the next couple of months? What are the chances of a second referendum? Can Brexit be stopped, or is the momentum too strong, do you think? And even if it involves a delay and so on, perhaps the Europe Research Group folks and will come in behind Theresa May because they fear that Brexit may be otherwise at risk.
There is deep uncertainty as to what will happen. I mean, first of all, we have to be quite clear that whatever else happens, all will not have been decided by the end of this month, because the agreement that Parliament is asked to agree to is only the first stage, and it doesn't involve any clarity as to what the ultimate aim is.
It's only the withdrawal agreement.
It's just the withdrawal agreement. So we can go on having a crisis for years in Britain. It's not going to end this month. A lot of the journalistic focus has been on this month, and of course it's an interesting story, but there is the bigger one. I have all along thought, since the so-called first referendum, which I think was the second one actually, but that's another matter. The first one was in the 70s when we voted to confirm British membership of the European Union. Anyway, I've all along thought that because it was quite clear the negotiations would be nightmarishly difficult, that there would be a political crisis at the end of the process, in the beginning of 2019, in which MPs would suddenly become important again. Because MPs had had really a terrible blow with the referendum. Because on the one hand, it is an absolute basis of democratic politics that you have to be willing to accept the judgment of the people, however stupid it may be. That willingness to get out of 10 Downing Street when you've been voted out is the basis of it all. And I suppose it is true that the same applies to referenda, although allow me just to say very briefly that my MP in Islington in the 1970s, when there was a referendum in Scotland on a substantial measure of independence for Scotland, he was a Scotsman representing a London constituency. He introduced a rule that it wasn't enough just to get a numerical majority. If you're getting a fundamental constitutional change in Britain, you need to have more than just a majority of those who voted on the day. And he put the rule down modestly as there had to be 40% of the registered voters supporting a proposition before it could be accepted. And on that basis, that particular proposal for a Scottish devolution, a quite drastic one, failed. And by the same standards, the referendum in 2016 would have failed. So the involvement of Parliament in referenda was amateurish, and it's maybe partly the problem of having no written constitution, that we don't have any pre-arranged rules for running these referenda. Now, that isn't a full answer to your question. Remind me of the essence of the question.
Well, the question was, what's going to happen?
Exactly. And the answer is, I think it's quite likely that there will be pressure for a second referendum. It might even happen. I've always hoped that it would, and I've always thought that it could only be usefully advocated near the end of the process, not to reject the first referendum, but to reject whatever unsatisfactory agreement has been reached. And I think it is possible that will happen. I support it personally, as you may have gathered. But other than that, it's possible that the threat to go off the cliff edge will fail, and that the leave the European Union without an agreement will fail. Mm. And Theresa May used that because she thought it was a very strong bargaining tool to be able to say that we would leave anyway, and it would strengthen her position in negotiations. And I understand that argument. In fact, I've once been in a position where I was involved in a negotiation, and I didn't care a damn whether there was an agreement or not. It was a conference, an Anglo-Soviet or Western Soviet conference in 1986 in Moscow. And I was deputed to do the negotiating for the Western side. For us, it didn't matter at all whether there was a final agreement or not, a communique. On the Soviet side, they had to have a communique. The result was that we could write the communique because we could threaten to walk out if anything that they wanted was put in it. So there is a certain strength, or there can be, in being in a position where you're willing to walk out of a negotiation. But on the other hand, Britain's entire trading policy is not like the matters with which I was dealing in Russia. And you need to know the day after you walk out what terms you're exporting on, what standards your products are being made to, all of that. Is it all tariff-free? And so on. You need to have every detail worked out. And unfortunately, it is not so. It's a threat to shoot ourselves in the foot, essentially. And I think one prediction I would make in answer to your question is, I think that MPs will rule it out. I think they will. They will
rule out a no deal.
Prevent, yes,
a no deal Brexit.
All right. Now we have about 20 minutes for questions. So please put your hand up and catch my eye if you'd like to ask a question. And as I said, Adam is a very interesting thinker on lots of different issues. So if you ask something that's slightly off the topic of Brexit, I might allow it. I'm going to go to this lady first, and then this gentleman down here.
Philippa Barr, I'm at Macquarie University. I have quite a lot of questions, but I'm going to just stick to one. I feel that Theresa May was very unsuccessful in breaking up the solidarity of the EU and of the EU countries. However, many of the leading or the dominant EU countries have relatively weak governments at the moment. France, Germany, Italy, they all have coalition governments. Is there any potential that she could have worked harder or could work harder to entice these countries to give to force the EU to give her and Britain a better deal?
Her own chief negotiator or advisor in the negotiations over Brexit, Sir Ivan Rogers, takes very strongly the view that she didn't understand the nature of the European Union and the ways in which it was profitable to negotiate with it. And in particular, he has said, I've heard him say it recently, and he's now said it publicly yesterday, that she had the idea that you could undermine the European Union's position by picking off one government at a time in bilateral negotiations. And he said that just doesn't work. You've got to be clear about what you want to achieve in negotiations with the European Union itself. And the European Union has some very talented negotiators, as well as some that are maybe not so good. But there was that feeling. I think more generally, the British have not had a wonderful record in negotiations in Europe because they have repeatedly, in one crisis or another, wanted to pick off individual governments, and they've treated Europe as if Europe was some vast artificial monolith, and Britain was the only country marching out of step. Now, what in fact all of that neglects is something that possibility that was there in many earlier crises, which is there were possibilities of alliance building within Europe that we neglected by loving to be in the position, which went down well with some voters, of rhetorically being the only country out of step. So there was a sort of problem there in the way in which negotiations were conducted and reported.
I would just add one observation, and that is that some people will recall that after Brexit, people were concerned that this would lead to other countries deciding to leave the European Union as well. So people talked about a Frexit and a Grexit and so on. But I think one effect of the shambolic nature of the Brexit negotiations is that most of those countries have looked at Britain and said, no thanks.
Yes, absolutely.
We don't want any of that. So I think that threat to European unity has been taken care of by our colleagues in the British Parliament. This gentleman with the blue tie, please.
Hello, my name is Frank van Beuningen. I'm Consul General for the Netherlands.
Welcome.
Thank you for sharing your insights with us. First of all, let me say that from a Netherlands perspective, we are very sorry to see the UK go. You're one of our bigger trading partners, so we have to see how it works out on that. And secondly, you're a staunch ally, with the Netherlands on discussions inside the European Union on free trade and the liberal order. My question concerns an aspect that you haven't touched upon yet, and that is geography. In particular, you mentioned your predecessor, Hadley Bull, in The Anarchy of States. He devotes one chapter to the relevance of geography in international relations. And my question is, why does the UK now take such a big political distance to countries in its proximity?
Well, I certainly agree in the importance of close relations between Britain and the Netherlands. And I agree that what has happened has been distressing from that point of view. England and the Netherlands have had very close relations since at least the 17th century. One of my ancestors-in-law was a British ambassador to the Netherlands in the 17th century. So it's in my bones to be aware of that connection. And as to why the British have seemingly neglected the powerful attractions of proximity and geography, I think that part of the story, sadly, has to be language. As you know, the British are rather lazy about languages. And there have been more English speakers outside Europe than in it. And they all have this distressing habit of talking in foreign languages in Europe. So I think just in terms of comfort zones, there may be an element there. Now, I have to exclude the Dutch from this generalization because the Dutch speak phenomenally good English, as we have just heard. So it's not what I've just said doesn't really fully explain it. And I think it's more in British rhetoric. It's never been a campaign against the Netherlands. It's always been a focus on Brussels. And as a student of a more distant organization, the United Nations, I've always been struck that the British press attacked mercilessly Brussels, sometimes on purely invented grounds, as when Boris Johnson wrote articles for the Daily Telegraph about non-existent European directives that he thought were utterly unreasonable.
On the shapes of bananas.
On the exactly. But that focus on Brussels meant that the UN escaped such attention from the British press. And as a student of the UN, I thought this was wonderful. You know, it's a lightning conductor. But of course, I was wrong, because the lightning conductor has now gone terribly wrong.
John Connor, no useful affiliation. One thing that struck me in much of the discussion that I've read from Britain on Brexit is that, on the one hand, a major sticking point is the customs union and its effect on the Ulster border. But there's been almost no discussion that I've read as to the probability of Ulster, in fact, staying in Britain, or rather going with the Republic. And so a little while ago I looked up, it's a very crude measure, the relative number of Catholics and Protestants in Ulster, and they're approximately equal. Mm. There's very little, and in fact the Catholic the numbers are growing rather more than the Protestants. And of course not all Catholics want to join the Republic, and not all Protestants want to stay in Britain. But nevertheless, this whole discussion seems to be proceeding on the assumption that if Brexit goes ahead, that Ulster will nevertheless remain part of Britain. And is part of that simply due to the fact that Theresa May has depended on those troglodytes in the DUP?
I would hesitate to use the exact language that you used about our colleagues from Northern Ireland, although I do find my relations with them difficult at times. I've twice had in the street in Northern Ireland, in Protestant areas, had young enthusiastic Presbyterian coming up to me and trying to persuade me of the sinfulness of my ways and the need to adopt the one true faith. And I had to explain to them that I've got Presbyterianism in my bones. My grandfather was a Presbyterian theologian and biblical scholar, and I'm not going to listen to any stuff from you. But you're right that there is a movement of opinion in Northern Ireland which would warm to the idea of unification if there was a crisis over Northern Ireland in following Brexit, following the actual implementation of Brexit. And the government's dependence on the Protestant votes is such that it would be very difficult for the government to even breathe a word about unification, because the Protestants are militantly opposed to unification with the Republic of Ireland. Although there is even there a slight generational issue, that some younger people on the Protestant side are more willing to think in terms of change. But on the whole, I think it's a very dangerous question. The possibility that Northern Ireland could unify with the Republic of Ireland would be likely in one way or another to contribute to violence in Northern Ireland. And so it's best avoided. And that means that the government's reliance on those Protestant votes helps it to avoid discussing the Irish question. It's being sort of evaded.
Adam, what about other parts of the union? So what are the chances that if Brexit proceeds, this gives more momentum to a push for Scottish independence, given Scotland's historic links to the continent and anti-Brexit feelings in Scotland? And also a kind of a different part of the country, London. There's no chance of London Brexiting and joining the EU, but is there a sense in which, what are the implications in the long term for the relationship between the capital and the rest of the country, given that the capital was so full-throated in its support for remaining a member of the European Union? Is there a risk that divide between London and the rest of the UK gets wider?
On the Scottish question, that's might have been a much bigger issue than it is at the moment, because you're right. On the whole, opinion in Scotland has been clearly pro-Europe, and Scotland voted to remain in the EU in the referendum. So it might seem to logically follow that if withdrawal from the EU is forced upon the Scots, they might, in one way or another, rebel, demand another independence vote, and so on. At the moment, it doesn't look likely. And the reason for that is that the Scottish government, Scottish National Party government, has overplayed its hand to the point where people are a bit fed up with politics. That's a natural condition of humankind, to be a bit fed up with politics. But it's quite strongly felt in Scotland. So it's far from clear that the consequence of a Brexit, if it happens, would be a Scottish rebellion of the kind you mentioned. As regards London, London is solidly pro-European Union, very conspicuously so, and it's part of the absurdity of the whole project that London, with its immense involvement in through business of one kind or another, service industries and so on, with European Union, is being cut off in this way, to an extent at least, from its normal natural partners in Europe. That's part of a bigger problem, which is that basically the more prosperous and the more educated parts of Britain are still strongly pro-European, pro-membership of the European Union. And there's an extraordinary interpretation of the election figures, which I heard a couple of weeks ago from a Labour member of the House of Lords, Baroness Jay. She said that every single British city with a university in it voted to remain in Europe, and every single major city in Britain without a university in it voted to leave. And actually, one of the truths about Britain is that some cities have been desperately left behind. For example, I've cycled through cities in Scotland where the whole of the main street is boarded up. And no wonder people in that kind of situation feel tempted to vote leave. They're just as a way of demonstrating that they are completely fed up.
So I'm going to take two questions at once and give Adam the opportunity to answer both of them.
My name is Jonathan Campbell-Jones. Professor, I agree with you. The quality of the referendum debate could definitely have been better. But do you think if it had been better, it would have made any difference? Do you think actually people needed a frightfully well-informed debate in order to be able to make up their mind? In other words, would a better informed debate have changed people's opinion? And apropos what you've just been saying about university towns, do you think actually the sophistication of the question put to the electorate was capable of being absorbed and dealt with by the British electorate?
And because I'm feeling in a happy mood today, I'm actually going to give this gentleman an opportunity. So we're going to do three questions to end with, Adam. Yes.
Thank you. I'm Ian Groden. I'm just a humble retiree living on a north shore in an island in the middle of the Pacific. So I don't fully understand the sociology of what's been going on. Even if the vote would have gone the other way, the fact that such a huge percentage of the population voted the way they did is some kind of a signal. And I want to understand the psychology of that signal. What were the arguments used by Cameron's opponents that touched the nerve? That, you know, was it a loss of identity? Was it some sort of a dream of a utopia after Brexit? What actually is going on in their minds that the British authorities should give a lot of attention to try and analyse, to try and help change.
Very good. Thank you, sir. And the last element, yes, this gentleman.
One extremely quick question. We're sitting here in Sydney. We've talked a lot about what this means for Britain, but what does it mean? Is it good or bad for a country like Australia or India or any of those countries outside of Europe? Looking at it selfishly from an Australian perspective, ironically, with a British accent, good or bad here?
So, Adam, you've got, there's three huge questions. You've got about 2 minutes to answer all three.
Yeah.
One is about, you know, would a better question have produced a different result, and was the question too sophisticated? One is, why did they vote this way? What was the underlying sociological reasons? And finally, forget Britain for a minute. Put your Australian cap on as Adam rather than Sir Adam. And what does it mean for Australia?
Yep. On the first, quality of the referendum debate, and would it have made any difference if it was a more impressive debate? Referenda are notorious as tests of opinion that actually provoke answers that are not necessarily on the exact question that's been asked. People will vote because they generally feel hard done by or for whatever other personal reason. And so there was a lot of that in the referendum voting. Could it have been, and it's an argument against referenda, and although I'm in favour of the so-called second referendum in this case, I do not in general think referenda are a good way of making decisions. Why? Well, partly it's because I do believe in the role of deliberative democracy, and that includes deliberation within Parliament, where people have to debate responsibly and carefully what's going on. And it's not in the interest of any individual to spend enormous effort studying the comparative advantages of different kinds of European economic arrangements if they're only one in 50 million voters. So I think that there's a built-in problem with referenda, made much worse by something we haven't discussed, which is the attitude to migrants and refugees. And that was a particularly scandalous use of the referendum device, where messages and advertisements appeared and newspaper stories appeared that Turkey was about to join the European Union and that 80 million Turks would be queuing up at Dover the next day to come to Britain. And I think that was one of the most scandalous misrepresentations of fact, but it achieved results. And so what was going on in the mind of voters was partly just a sense that things are out of control and that we want to stop that. And incidentally, again, nothing we haven't discussed, but the role of new media, electronic media, was a huge worry. And the more that has come out of it about the sums of money spent on electronic media and the uses made of personal information in it suggests a really serious need on the part of all countries and perhaps internationally as well to get to grips with these media and to ensure that there is some responsibility at some point in the process of advertising or putting in the public domain stories which may be completely devoid of any basis in fact. And something quite strong needs to be done about that. And it's true in the United States as well. The role of Cambridge Analytica we haven't discussed in this, but it's too late to embark on it now. But it was a major issue. And then the question asked by our humble retiree friend about what's been going on, what was going on in the mind of voters. I hope I've given some clue as to that. On the last question, is it good for Australia? I think it is not good for Australia, in that the lack of confidence it engenders in democratic institutions is something that could be dangerously infectious. I'm not a believer that history's arrow goes only one way, and that the history of the world is a history of the gradual triumph of democracy and liberal values. It's a two-way process, and you have to be willing to see things go in the wrong direction sometimes, and not merely assume that all will go in the right direction. And that two-way process may have some nasty bumps in the road for Australia as well as for the United Kingdom. But Michael, I leave it to you to answer more fully on Australia than I possibly could.
I don't really want to have the last word, but I mean, I would agree with what Adam says. I'd just add that that the weakening of the West, we're a part of the West, and the weakening of the West, the distraction of Britain in the long term, will make it harder for us, for Australia to play the kind of role we want. So I think all I can do as a loyal former student of Sir Adam Roberts is say what he said. ladies and gentlemen, I said at the start that that Adam is the quintessential Oxford Don in that he has interesting things to say on almost any subject. And I think he has shown that in spades. And I think you can see how I hit the jackpot when I was assigned Adam Roberts as my supervisor. Adam, I want to finish just with a short metaphor about Brexit, or an analogy really, not from a scholar but from a comedian called James Acaster. I don't know if anyone has seen this on YouTube, but he said that thinking about Brexit is about like deciding whether to leave your tea bag in your cup of tea. He said, if you leave the tea bag in, then over time the cup of tea itself gets stronger. It might appear that the bag is getting weaker, but it's now part of a stronger cup of tea. Whereas if you take the bag out, the tea is now quite weak and the bag goes directly in the bin. So we certainly, as Anglophiles here, we certainly hope that the bag doesn't go directly in the bin. We are worried about the strength of your tea, but we couldn't have had a better person to tell us about the intricacies, the ins and outs, and the historical context of Brexit than Sir Adam Roberts. So please join me in thanking him. Thank you very much.